lead to accidents, injuries, and long-term health issues. Furthermore, child laborers perpetuate cycle of poverty, as these exploited children are more likely to remain trapped in low-paying, exploitative jobs as adults.
Child labor is prevalent in the United States. I mean, it's supposed to be regulated, but there are violations. So, for example, that children are allowed to work across the country at age 16. There's regulations in terms of how many hours do they work. They're not supposed to work during school hours. During the school year, there's limitations on how many hours that they can work. And during the summer, when they're off from school, they're only allowed to work 40 hours. However, in some industries and in some areas, there is a prevalence of child labor violations where children are working in agriculture. So there are exceptions for agriculture. However, the exploitation is really happening with undocumented minors and the children of migrants. And so in areas where there is agriculture, there is a lot of child labor violations. And also in some meat packing areas and industries, and that there are people that do exploit children by identifying low wage labor and cutting corners to allow for children to be exploited.
Child labor in the United States disproportionately affect African American and minority communities, exacerbating existing social and economic disparities. While these communities often face higher rates of poverty and limited access to quality education and employment opportunities, making them more vulnerable to exploitation. The existing poverty among these families make child labor a means of survival.
One was in illegal immigrant communities where just like no laws are present because the companies are keeping them in situations where they're sort of off the books. Or within extremist religious communities where kids are born outside of the healthcare system and the communities have very different cultural norms. And I think that these are two very different instances. I think within the extremist religious communities, the way that child labor is engaged with can be very healthy. So you might see this in Amish communities or something, you know, where the kids are going to school, but also expected to work a certain number of days on the family farm. And it's just sort of their cultural tradition. And I think that that's a very, you know, it's an older culture. It's a different culture than the predominant culture in our society, but I wouldn't see it as an exploitative culture. They're not making their kids work because they see them as inexpensive labor. They're having their kids work because that's part of how you learn to be a healthy, functioning adult within their culture. Within the illegal immigrant communities, it's not that kids are being explicitly forced to work. It's that the organizations which allow for large pools of illegal immigrant communities to work for them just don't really care about the well-being of the people who are working for them. But again, this is fairly rare, and it's only growing in size due to the growing illegal immigrant population in the U.S.
Minority communities, including migrant populations, also face unique challenges in relation to child labor. Language barriers, lack of awareness about labor rights, and fear of deportation create conditions ripe for exploitation. Children from these communities often find themselves working in industries such as agriculture, construction, and domestic work where their rights are easily overlooked. What are the primary reasons that children are pushed into labor in the U.S.?
So the factors that lead to children being exploited in labor is really really due to our unjust immigration system, that there are many children coming from Central America, children of migrants who are forced into labor because they are outside of the system and because of their vulnerable legal status, that they are exploited and can't report the violations of labor laws. they are forced into labor. Also, I mean, families are really struggling to pay the bills, to feed themselves. There's food insecurity. These things are large factors in what leads to children working to support their families and to support themselves.
In 1989, world leaders adopted the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is an international treaty that sets out the civil, political, economic, and other rights of the children. The United States is still the only country among the UN member states that has not signed this international treaty.
The demographic group most affected by child labor in the U.S. are illegal immigrant populations. The reason for this is because they are not on the legal books within the U.S., so the kids can't be as easily tracked as children who are citizens or children who are legal immigrants, because then they can still be tracked. So for somebody to be a child laborer in the U.S., the legal system needs to essentially not know they exist, and that's very hard to do.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, child labor violations have increased by 69% since 2018, and from that year to 2022, more than 15,000 children were discovered to be illegally employed. The Department of Labor also revealed that the number of minors employed in violation of federal law almost tripled between 2013 and 2022. Why are states loosening child labor prevention laws?
The states that are working to loosen child labor laws, they are being influenced by the industry, by the agricultural meatpacking industry. You can see the businesses that are really pushing for these laws. My belief is that the corporations don't have the best interest of their workers or the communities, their customers at heart, that to exploit child labor and to fight for that is something that is unjust, especially when we should be working to create pathways for citizenships and making sure that every child has an opportunity to get their education and to live to their best ability and to use their talents to support themselves and their families. And the best way that we can do that is by allowing children to attend school and to graduate high school, and eventually, if they choose to, join a trade or go to college.
Children are often hired to work in hazardous jobs where risks of injuries are high and children more vulnerable. The United States Government Accountability Office revealed that 452 children died due to workplace injuries between 2003 and 2016. 75 of these children were younger than 12 years old. Based on the U.S. Fair Labor Standards Act, if a child worker is seriously injured or killed on the job, the maximum fine is less than $69,000.
That there were minors employed across the country between the ages of 13 and 17 working the overnight shift.
This was not a mistake.
There's no way that this was just a mistake.
How many minors did you identify?
102 minors at 13 different plants in 8 different states.
PSSI says there is a, quote, company-wide prohibition against child labor, and it checks the eligibility of employees. But the problem expands far beyond just one company. Currently, several McDonald's franchisees are under investigation after more than 300 minors were found working in violation of federal labor laws. Investigators say the majority of the violations were in the state of Kentucky. This all comes as Republicans in several states are pushing legislation that would allow minors to work longer hours and to be placed in dangerous conditions.
The Economic Policy Institute reported in March 2023 that proposals to reduce or roll back child labor protections and child labor law violations are both on the rise across the country. The number of minors employed in violation of child labor laws increased by 37% in the previous year, while at least 10 states introduced or passed laws rolling back child labor protections in the past 2 years.
the current laws that we have, there needs to be more that can be done to protect children from labor exploitation and to support families. So the laws and regulations that are supposed to protect child labor, it goes beyond that. We need to think about asylum laws and making sure that we extend asylum for unaccompanied minors, and to make sure that children or migrants have the protections and their human rights respected. So I think that our laws need to go further, and that we need better social services to ensure that children are protected and that their parents are also protected if there are going to be whistleblowers or report the industries that are exploiting them and their families.
Iowa loosened child labor laws by signing a bill in May to extend teens' working hours and to expand the establishment where they are allowed to be employed. This law also permits teens as young as 16 to serve alcohol in restaurants during the hours food is being served, provided they have written permissions from teens' parents or guardian. According to this law, 14-year-olds are now able to work in industrial laundry services, freezers, and meat coolers.
It's not that children can't work. Most people get a job as a teenager. I did. I assume you two did. But children are not allowed to work the most dangerous jobs. So that includes roofing, factory work, and working in a slaughterhouse overnight, like these 100 children were doing. That kind of work is off limits until you're 18. Children also are not allowed to work overnight shifts. And really, most of these laws come back to the children's physical safety. The idea is that it's fine for children to get some kind of after-school job, but we really don't want kids working jobs that can start to make them sick, where they can get hurt or, you know, even die. And what we're seeing is more and more children in this country are ending up in exactly that kind of work, especially migrant children. We've seen nearly 300,000 migrant children cross the border on their own just in the last 2 years. And my reporting shows that the majority of those kids are ending up working full time.
Child labor laws are more relaxed in the agriculture industry. Low-paying, difficult, and dangerous work in tobacco fields is legal for unlimited hours. Children 12 years or older are authorized to work unlimited hours outside school hours in agriculture. Children working in this industry are killed at a much higher rate than other children working in other industries. Should children be allowed to work, or should the government stop families from sending children to work?
Outside of that, when we think about children working, we do have laws of where they're not supposed to be before the age of 14. And I think that is reasonable. There may be certain things where they're learning skills, and that's expected to actually get into colleges and universities and different programs.
A series of investigative reports have revealed recently that overwhelming migrant children from Central America are taking on some of the most dangerous jobs in the U.S. New York Times reporter Hannah Dreyer estimated that 250,000 children crossed the border into the U.S. without their parents in the last 2 years, and a majority ended up working full-time jobs.
So the major demographic that is impacted by child labor violations are Central and South Americans, migrants, who are being targeted. And this is because our immigration system is unjust, and it really is intended to create a permanent underclass in the United States.
Undocumented immigrants often face limited employment options and are more susceptible to exploitation due to their fear of deportation and lack of legal protections. Some children from these families are forced to work to supplement family income, sacrificing their education and childhood in the process. The immigration system itself contributes to the prevalence of child labor, with lengthy processing times, limited visa options, and a lack of legal pathways for immigrant workers.
I'm not going to let my child work in this kind of situation. And I think most parents are not going to send their children into the slaughterhouse. But I talked to the children who were working at these slaughterhouses that were featured in the 60 Minutes reports, and they're here without their parents. They've come across the border on their own, and they're staying with a family friend, maybe an uncle they've never met. And they are under so much pressure to earn money, to pay rent, to pay for food, to pay off a debt in a lot of cases. They end up getting these jobs and there's nobody else watching out for them to sort of keep them safe. And what we're seeing is that they're ending up exploited in the worst way.
The COVID-19 pandemic also pushed teens into labor market, where many companies struggled to find employees. Older workers were not interested in low-paying jobs, especially during that time where the government provided stimulus funds and they were afraid of the pandemic threat. In Michigan, the minimum wage for working minors is only 85% of the regular minimum wage.
So there are some incentives for children to begin to work or to contribute and to have that type of autonomy. I think it's important that we have these conversations and to ensure that our most vulnerable people in our society, and that really is our children. So when we think about the millions of children working, the 300,000 children working in labor fields, that we do our best to protect them and to ensure that they have their needs met and that they have pathways to citizenship and their education guaranteed.
The Biden administration detained tens of thousands of children seeking asylum. They were then placed with the sponsors and accepted forced work to survive. The sponsors have created a business taking advantage of the vulnerability of these children, sending them to work and taking their paycheck. Many of these migrants end up working dangerous jobs in slaughterhouses, construction sites, and car factories.
So every summer now of the Biden administration, we have seen a record number of children coming across the border, and they've started to back up in the system that processes them, which has led to children sleeping on the floor, children sleeping under those metal blankets, wall-to-wall coverage of a crisis at the border. And there's been a lot of pressure to move those kids out more quickly. And the result has been some kids have been sent to places they never should have been sent. They've been released to adults who have then turned right around and put them to work, taken their paychecks, and almost labor trafficked them.
Depending on the circumstances of families in different countries and communities, there might be some work required to be carried out by underage children. However, the problem in the United States is not these isolated examples. Large corporations are taking advantage of children, especially those of illegal immigrants, to carry out jobs, working long hours and receiving less pay, and essentially feeding the greed of American corporations.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us, the Ahlul Bayt, and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell." Thank you.
in the limelight.
Sentiment among U.S. consumers declined in July more than expected, and for the first time in 4 months, turmoil in the financial markets added to growing expectations of a recession in the coming year. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. New data showed ever-increasing numbers of people are raiding their savings pots due to cost-of-living crisis. According to the latest report by Hargreaves Lansdowne and Oxford Economics, 1 in 3 people now don't have enough cash for emergencies. This is up from 1 in 4 just 18 months ago. According to new Office of National Statistics figures, although inflation has eased slightly, it remains at 7.9%, and the cost of many essential items is still rising at a clip. According to Sarah Coles, head of personal finance at stockbroker Hargreaves Lansdowne, we're now seeing savers eat into their cash buffers many managed to build up during the pandemic. Many households spent less than normal during the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, helping them to save cash. Sarah Coles says, our savings have been savaged over the past 18 months as runaway prices rises have flattened our financial resilience. Sarah Coles added, we've been spending our way through any cash we were able to set aside during lockdowns, and we've eaten into the money we set aside for the dire emergencies as well. Coles said, lockdown savings are protecting millions of people from running into a brick wall financially. She added, however, those who weren't able to save anything during the pandemic have nothing to fall back on and face a serious risk of building impossible debts. The report shows the areas of the country with the highest and lowest proportions of people with sufficient emergency funds in place. Emergency funds act as a financial cushion to deal with unforeseen events such as losing your job or an expensive emergency, like home repairs. Personal finance experts believe an emergency fund should cover between 3 to 6 months' worth of basic living expenses. According to the data, London and the Home Counties have the highest proportion of people with at least 3 to 6 months' worth of expenses in emergency savings. In Merseyside and southern Scotland, around half of people don't have 3 to 6 months of expenses in emergency savings in the bank. Merseyside in particular has seen the proportion of people with 3 to 6 months of savings fall from 68% to 51% over the past 18 months. Meanwhile, Devon, Essex and West Wales also feature among the regions with the lowest saving rates. Sarah Coles said, the higher cost of living has hit those on lower incomes hardest and laid waste to savings in Northern England and Southern Scotland in particular. She noted, in some areas only around half of people have enough savings to protect them from the unexpected. Sarah Coles added, aside from wealthy outer London, west and northwest, the past 18 months have seen savings fall across the board in both those areas with plenty of savings and those who are struggling. However, this has clearly had a far more profound impact in places where fewer people had sufficient savings to start with. The real divide is between people at the different income levels, with 28% of the lowest fifth of earners holding enough emergency savings compared to 92% of the highest fifth of earners. However, other factors have a huge impact as well. Parenthood is expensive, which is why single parents have such low levels of savings. Just 24% have 3 to 6 months' worth of savings. Those on lower incomes with children are hit even harder. Only 15% of the poorest parents have 3 to 6 months of spare cash. Anna Bose, co-founder of the savings website Savings Champion, believes that cash pots will likely continue to evaporate over the coming months. Anna Bose says, "It's of great concern that people appear to be unable to save enough cash for emergencies, never mind other spending requirements. But unfortunately, with the ongoing cost of living crisis, this trend is likely to continue for the foreseeable future." She added, "And unfortunately, when people fall out of the habit, it can be a hard one to resume." According to Anna Bose, under normal circumstances, people should all try to keep around 3 to 6 months' worth of normal income for emergencies, so they can cover essential costs should the unexpected happen. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to data that recorded the largest drop in sentiment for more than 1 year, British consumer confidence plummeted in July as the rising cost of borrowing and higher prices hit people's morale. Research group GfK said on Friday, 21st of July, the Consumer Confidence Index, a measure of how Britons view their personal finances and wider economic prospects, fell 6 percentage points to minus 30 in July compared with the previous month. The latest reading marked the first fall in expectations since January and the largest drop since April of last year. Joe Staton, Client Energy Director at GfK, said that for the first 6 months of 2023, expectations had improved despite the continuing cost of living crisis, with double-digit inflation outpacing income growth and rising interest rates affecting homeowners and renters alike. However, referring to the July data, he said, "Suddenly, this resilience has collapsed." The survey was conducted in the first 2 weeks of July, before news that inflation fell more than 7.9% in June led investors to trim their expectations of an interest rate rise at the next Bank of England meeting in August. Markets are now pricing in an interest rate peak of 5.75% to 6%, which could ease pressure on mortgage holders. On Wednesday, 19th of July, data provider MoneyFacts reported that the average 2-year fixed residential mortgage rate fell to 6.79%, down from an average rate of 6.81% on the previous day. Despite the fall, the figure was still more than double the rate offered at the start of last year. Britain's expectations for the general economy and their personal finances fell, dropping 8 percentage points and 6 percentage points, respectively. Linda Ellett, Head of Consumer Markets in Britain, Leisure and Retail for KPMG, said, "Despite efforts by households to reduce costs where they can, for some, those efforts are simply dwarfed by the sizable jumps in mortgages or rent that they're facing." The GfK index, tracking whether consumers thought it was a good time to make big purchases, an indicator of spending intentions, dropped 7 percentage points to minus 32. Staton said he expected consumer confidence would not substantially improve until prices and interest rates fell. He added, "Reality has started to bite and people continue to struggle to make ends meet. Consumers will pull back from spending." the eight-year defense of Iranian combatants
against Iran. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said...
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
unilateral... President Raisi has emphasized that...
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
This is what it looks like typically, a peaceful march of the masses, and a lot of youngsters joining in the beat. Actually, it is to mourn the beloved grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. He was a 7th century revolutionary leader who made the ultimate sacrifice for social justice against the tyrant ruler of the time, Yazid.
Some things never get old, such as sorrow and inspiration, the struggle for basic rights and dignity, and aspiring for betterment. Each year, this country is shrouded in black to mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions while honoring the Battle of Karbala. For a closer look at what this event inspires today, please join us on this edition of Iran Today. The Battle of Karbala is one of the most significant events in Islamic history. Imam Hussein's refusal to accept the tyrant Yazid's allegiance triggered the Battle of Karbala on the day of Ashura. On this day in the year 680 AD or 61 Hijra, Imam Hussein, along with his family members and companions, were martyred on the plains of Karbala, and this marks a turning point for Islamic Ummah. The resistance movement that ensued came to be known as Imam Hussein's Revolution.
Resistance is in fact a ramification of Ashura. When you come to realize with regard to the Muslim world that the enemies of Islam, enemies of people, enemies of this geographical zone have mobilized their forces for maximum dominance, be it cultural, economic, or geopolitical, upon regional nations, the common political logic, be it liberalism or nationalism, failed to find an answer. Even the most leading anti-hegemony movement, for example Marxism, which itself grew into a new force of dominance, failed to overpower capitalism and imperialism.
Imam Hussein was beheaded, as were his 72 companions slain and many others who were taken as captive. Among those killed was Imam's 6-month-old baby boy and some other children. The presence of infants and children in the camp bears the question whether the resistance was pre-planned or consequential. But it happened. The blood of pure souls was shed. And over a millennium and a half later, mourning Ashura will be commemorated. But why do people hold the Tasua Ashura ceremony each year? What current events over time have kept the flame alive?
One instance is the martyrdom of Haj Qasim Soleimani, which created a huge movement in Iran and the countries in the region, as a great commander like Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was martyred alongside him. The two great figures fought against the enemies together. Remember, after the assassination of Qasim Soleimani, people from all walks of life, tendencies, appearances, even those who didn't adhere to religious laws, came out to protest. It's exactly what we're witnessing in Lebanon, where many of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's followers are Christians who practice their own religion, but their political thought follows the idea of resistance.
Muslims, especially Shias, view the tragedy of Karbala as the ultimate sacrifice and the triumph of truth over falsehood. Each year during the first 10 days of the month of Muharram, Muslims all over the world mourn the sacrifices made by Imam Hussein and his companions. More than 1,340 years after Imam Hussein's martyrdom, Baghdad, Tehran, Islamabad, and other major cities in the world are adorned every year during Muharram with symbols of piety and repentance. Red flags for Imam's blood, symbolic black funeral tents, and black dress for mourning. Processions of men and boys expressing fervor in the ritual of chest beating and self-flagellation with chains.
Imam Hussein said that I'm not afraid of Yazid and death. I have one goal, and that is to save the religion of Prophet Muhammad. The religion brought by Prophet Muhammad was slowly being destroyed and corrupted after 50 years by Yazid. There's no insurance that an uprising and revolution will survive to bear fruits. But as you see today, the efforts of the Prophet Muhammad have paid off. And that's why today's Muslims worship God, and no Muslim says that, for example, Prophet Muhammad is the son of God, like Christians or Jews. We don't have such things in Islam. The reason is that the blood of Imam Hussein ensured the religion of Prophet Muhammad.
Only in the holy city of Karbala, where Imam Hussein was laid to rest, some 22 million Muslim Shias gathered to pay homage in the 10-day mourning ceremony, ending with Tasua and Ashura, which represent the 9th and 10th day of the ceremony, respectively, and also on Arbaeen, which is the 40-day anniversary of Ashura. Those who can make it commemorate the triumph of blood over sword in their local setting. The Iranian nation, among 200 million Muslims worldwide, are black-clad at large during the month of Muharram, especially the first 10 days. And also on Arbaeen, the 40th commemorative day that falls into the following month of Safar, the largest annual pilgrimage in the world happens, as millions of people go to the city of Karbala in Iraq. Muharram is among Islamic months labeled the haram or forbidden months, when war is prohibited. In other words, Husseini resistance is meant to be peaceful. Interestingly, and contrary to what's been portrayed in mainstream Western media, the Islamic resistance appears to have been more successful, perhaps even the only successful movement against the U.S. hegemony and Zionist regime tyranny, apparently because of its enduring peaceful nature.
Imam Hussein's conduct in the face of enemy troops carries a social lesson. When the enemy troops were approaching, Imam Hussein did not cease to worry about their concerns, including physical health, like possible thirst. Therefore, Imam Hussein immediately ordered commanders and water distributors to supply waters to enemy troops. When we see such conducts, we can't remain indifferent towards fellow humans.
Holy Quran has stated, "You are the best people who have evolved for mankind, enjoying what is right, forbidding what is wrong, and believing in Allah." Imam Hussein sacrificed everything in the way of safeguarding this institution and enforcing it. The Imam gave a more sober meaning to death in this cause. It has become to imply grandeur and honor. Since he set out on his journey from Medina to Karbala, he was always talking about death in dignity and honor. That is the death in the cause of right, truth, and justice. It has been said by his followers that such a death is akin to a beautiful necklace that adorns the neck of a young woman.
Imam Hussein was not looking for immediate results of his movement. See, when Imam Khomeini was arrested in 1963, the Savak officer in charge said to Imam Khomeini, "You poor clergy who has nothing but the clothes you're wearing, what hope and with which army and help do you want to stand against a 2,500-year-old monarchy?" In response, Imam Khomeini said, "My companions are now in their cradles." See, this view is very high. Imam Hussein has found his followers in the heart of the history, and his followers are increasing every day. The army of 20 million people who go to visit Imam Hussein in Arbaeen, these are who go to Karbala to visit Imam Hussein's grave in Arbaeen, these are the companions of Imam Hussein. The man who had only 18 companions when he left Medina for Mecca on the first day of his uprising.
Congregations of believers on Ashura Day is a way of enlivening these religious beliefs among youngsters, as the most popular cantors trigger their energy and thoughts. The Imam often recited a line of poetry en route in his fateful journey to Karbala. The poem read something like this: "Despite the fact that this life is sweet and beautiful, yet the next life is sweeter and more beautiful. Since in the end, man will leave behind after death all the worldly possessions, the good comes out of giving away one's wealth in good causes instead of hoarding it. By the same token, since the human body would turn to dust after death, why should not man die a sweet and honorable death? Thus, dying with a sword in the cause of God is much greater and lovelier." We mentioned how Ashura was a mobilizing force to the axis of resistance, in turn mobilizing the region in facing the U.S. and Zionist regime and recently Wahhabi and Takfiri sects. You recall General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in January 2020. He was instrumental in defeating Daesh or ISIS in Syria and Iraq by moving forces he likened to Imam Hussein and his small army of friends and family. In fact, Commander Soleimani often referred to Iranians as the nation of Imam Hussein and expected them to plant the seeds of sacrifice, sacrifice in resisting oppressors and seeking justice everywhere. We asked what similarities could be found between the Islamic resistance of today and the event of Ashura. The history of Islam is 1,400 years old and more. Now you get to see the discrepancies even in the political accounts of the day. But all the sects of the Islamic Ummah agree on the ill done to the descendants of the Prophet of Islam and the suffering of Imam Hussein and his companions. How we apply the lesson in today's world, though, matters much. Iran's method is the resistance against foreign forces in the region and their strongholds, especially the one slowly wiping the holy shrines and Palestine off the map, Israel. Today, resistance on another front is also of paramount importance. Iran's national interests define how far it will persist with the course of the JCPOA negotiations. Iran will never return to its commitments unless the U.S. and its European allies fully implement their obligations under the deal.
There are many free thinkers in the world like Gandhi who had no religious affiliation with Islam but sanctified Imam Hussein and honored him as their leader. This is true in Muslim countries, both among Shiites and Sunnis. Imam Hussein is influential and inspiring as a descendant of Prophet Muhammad and a great martyr. This has been the case for years, and we believe it will continue to be so in the future and will make more important impacts in human civilization.
Iran's support for Palestinian groups has been a key feature in spearheading pro-resistance and pan-Islamic solidarity. Groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Secular Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Iran's support for and by the Axis stems from its revolutionary ideology of wanting to be a cause, not just a country.
Imam Hussein ma usture ki dar muzey tarikh bashad nist. Imam Hussein ma ye imam zinde ast.
Our Imam Hussein is not a myth that belongs in historical museums. Our Imam Hussein is a living Imam, which means that right now, these people who are mourning in the streets, we who are wearing black clothes, are not looking to get a memorial for Imam Hussein. We intend to announce what is the duty of the Muslim nations today and how they should continue the path of Imam Hussein. And this movement continues until oppression, tyranny, and oppressive governments are destroyed, and the religion of Islam rules all over the world, and peace and justice are established.
For and since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran's leaders have legitimized acts of resistance and uprising if recognized to be anti-oppression. While the eight-year war waged on Iran is an unquestionable example. In drawing on the Ashura narrative of the victims, voiceless but standing, perhaps hoping for time to set the record straight, this country interestingly did this. When Iran accepted UN Resolution 598 for the ceasefire with Iraq, its substantial demand was not war reparations, but to be recognized as the victim of invasion. And that it finally achieved.
After a nation rises up, if it persists and values its uprising and believes in it, the uprising turns to resistance. If the resistance continues, it will change to endurance and become long-lasting. In our opinion, the Iranian people's uprising turned into resistance, then took the form of endurance, and now has been internalized to the point where they exercise perseverance in the face of all the hardships and sanctions and choose their uprising over giving up. Between resistance and surrender, they choose the former.
I would say that those who were today fighting Daesh have done much more sacrifice than what we did. Those who are fighting Daesh in Syria have much stronger faith than our generation. We really envy them and we feel that we are distant from them.
Another example is resistance against Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And in case you're wondering how it all started, revolutionary Shiism emerged in the 1960s consistent with global anti-colonial movements. It centered on resistance against oppression with a look to Muslim fighters and martyrdom and by drawing on the Karbala metaphor. To Iran as a state, the tale is more than a script for passion plays or even history books. The post-revolution constitution commands support for the oppressed and Muslims of the world, and is claimed to have been inspired by the ordeal of Imam Hussein and companions. How bravely Imam Hussein fought would not matter if his intention were to definitely score a win. He was surrounded by an army many times larger than his that attacked from all sides with swords, spears, and arrows. And eventually Shamr ruthlessly beheaded him, thirsty and heavily wounded. But fear not, for wars carry far and long, and that's all a legacy needs to be relayed and learned from. Here's where Zainab, peace be upon her, the first narrator of the occasion, came in.
After Imam Hussein and his companions are martyred in the scene of Ashura, their enemies take Hazrat Zainab as a captive and chain her, taking the captives from city to city in the worst possible way until they reach the Levant. They cheer to humiliate the family of Imam Hussein, but the exact opposite of what they wanted happened. Because Hazrat Zainab was an orator so skillful that people said it was as if Imam Ali was speaking when he delivered a speech. While giving a speech in Yazid's court, she commanded everyone to silence, and all the participants in the majestic court of Yazid immediately became silent to listen to her sermons. Her speech made Yazid's family, who was sitting behind a veil, cry and oppose him. Her sermons were so powerful that his rule didn't last long after.
The merging of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance movement with the ideals of the Ashura Uprising can be seen in Chapter 10 on Foreign Policy of Article 152 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which bases the country's foreign policy on the rejection of any kind of dominance, the preservation of the all-inclusive independence of the country, the defense of the rights of all Muslims, and non-alignment in relation to the domineering powers.
We have witnessed many uprisings throughout history calling for justice and an end to corruption. How is Imam Hussein's movement any different from those? What are its distinguishing and inspiring characteristics?
قیام‌های دیگران یک اهداف بسیار کوتاه‌مدتی داشته.
Other uprising of the world compared to the uprising of Imam Hussein are very limited and have short-term goals. For example, Gandhi sought to save India from Western colonialism, and he was somehow successful. The Great French Revolution is another example, and other uprisings followed suit. But Imam Hussein pursued goals that were not bound to time and place. Some think that Imam Hussein wanted to form a small government to resist Yazid's government, and that's it. While in the final hours of Ashura Day, he kinda portrayed the final peak of his movement for his son, and he said, "I swear by God, my blood will not calm down until the emergence of Muhammad ibn al-Hassan al-Mahdi." That is the 12th Imam of Shias.
The Islamic Revolution started from religious mourning gatherings. These gatherings have been special as they recount the truths about Ashura and underline the importance of fighting against evil, although with a few fighters. This is significant as people are shown how to follow the truth in the way Imam Hussein and his companions did.
We said the Islamic resistance had been successful. Since 1979, Revolutionary Islam has linked Tehran with a network of groups in the region. These include Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, the Shia militias in Syria, and the Houthis in Yemen, just to mention a few. And it's not just a matter of fighting power, but more importantly, winning the hearts and minds of regional Islamic Ummah.
What is the major impact of Imam Hussein's movement on the recent resistance movements?
All the movements of Palestinians, the people of Gaza, and the leaders of resistance are derived from the teachings of Imam Hussein. How was Haj Qasim able to create an alliance between the resistance movements? What was Haj Qasim's role model? In his talks, we have heard many times that he says that we are the nation of Imam Hussein, which means we are the nation of resistance.
Basically, any uprising that arises to fight against oppression becomes permanent, and truth-seeking and righteous people will follow it. The uprising of Ashura is a complete tragedy due to its unique historical characteristics. It's an event in which women and children were involved from its creation until it ended in conveying the message of resistance and perseverance.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam stood up against the deviated current of his time, which was extremely dangerous. And this became a lesson, and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam himself makes the same point. That is to say, he backed up his action with the order of Islam. He said that his duty was what he was doing. He said that he had to express his opposition, no matter what the consequences were. He said, "It is good if my destiny is a victory, and if my destiny is martyrdom, so much the better." This was how Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam acted.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
This was a perfect instance of self-sacrifice, and it safeguarded Islam. This move preserved Islam. This move institutionalized values in society. If Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had not accepted this danger, if he had not made a move, if he had not taken action, if his blood had not been shed, if those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter, and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam al-Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did was extraordinary feats. That is to say, the dimensions of his actions are far more than what we estimate. We usually ignore aspects and details. Once, I spoke about Imam al-Hussein's alayhi salam patience. His patience was not limited to enduring thirst or seeing his companions being killed. These things are relatively easy to tolerate. The kind of patience that is difficult to practice is to listen to influential, aware, and respectable people who keep creating doubts and telling you that what you are doing is dangerous and wrong.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has wrapped up the 11th edition of aerial drills codenamed Defenders of Velayat Sanctuary. During the two-day nationwide maneuvers, Air Force units conducted a full range of operations and exercised various tactics using drones, fighter jets, transport, logistical, and refueling aircraft, as well as air ambulances. The operations were conducted over various areas from the Persian Gulf to the northwestern and northeastern regions. The main stage of the drills kicked off in the central province of Isfahan on Sunday night, as fighter jets and bombers carried out nocturnal operations and detonated the mock enemy's ground targets with Qasid-upgraded standoff missiles. The Iranian military drones also conducted major operations. Various combat, reconnaissance and electronic warfare UAVs such as Kaman 12, Karar, Mohajer 6 and Arash destroyed targets using different modified bombs with pinpoint accuracy. On the sideline of the drills in Isfahan, the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, hailed the Air Force for achieving the main objectives of the maneuvers, saying the country's military